parties to a quarrel. I won't be one. You may go to the devil, said I. Don't say that, he replied. I know you'll be sorry afterwards. How can you make yourself so inferior to me as to show such a bad spirit? But I forgive you. You forgive me? I repeated disdainfully. I do. And you can't help yourself, replied Uriah. To think of your going and attacking me, that have always been a friend to you. But there can't be a quarrel without two parties, and I won't be one. I will be a friend to you in spite of you. So now you know what you've got to expect. The necessity of carrying on this dialogue, his parting, which was very slow, mine very quick, in a low tone that the house might not be disturbed at an unseasonable hour, did not improve my temper, though my passion was cooling down. Merely telling him that I should expect from him what I always had expected and had never yet been disappointed in, I opened the door upon him as if he had been a great walnut put there to be cracked, and went out of the house. But he slept out of the house too, at his mother's lodgings, and before I'd gone many hundred yards, came up with me. "You know, Copperfield," he said in my ear. I didn't turn my head. "You're in quite a wrong position," which I felt to be true, and that made me chafe the more. "You can't make this a brave thing, and you can't help being forgiven. I don't intend to mention it to Mother, nor to any living soul. I'm determined to forgive you. But I do wonder that you should lift your hand against a person that you knew to be so humble." I felt only less mean than he. He knew me better than I knew myself. If he'd retorted or openly exasperated me, it would have been a relief and a justification. But he had put me on a slow fire on which I lay tormented half the night. In the morning, when I came out, the early church bell was ringing, and he was walking up and down with his mother. He addressed me as if nothing had happened, and I could do no less than reply. I had struck him hard enough to give him the toothache, I suppose. At all events, his face was tied up in a black silk handkerchief, which, with his hat perched on the top of it, was far from improving his appearance. I heard that he went to a dentist's in London on the Monday morning and had a tooth out. I hope it was a double one. The doctor gave out that he wasn't quite well, and remained alone for a considerable part of every day during the remainder of the visit. Agnes and her father had been gone a week before we resumed our usual work. On the day preceding its resumption, the doctor gave me with his own hands a folded note not sealed. It was addressed to myself, and laid an injunction on me in a few affectionate words, never to refer to the subject of that evening. I had confided it to my aunt, but to no one else. It was not a subject I could discuss with Agnes, and Agnes certainly had not the least suspicion of what had passed. Neither, I felt convinced, had Mrs. Strong then. Several weeks elapsed before I saw the least change in her. It came on slowly, like a cloud when there's no wind. At first she seemed to wonder at the gentle compassion with which the doctor spoke to her, and at his wish that she should have her mother with her to relieve the dull monotony of her life. Often, when we were at work and she was sitting by, I would see her pausing and looking at him with that memorable face. Afterwards, I sometimes observed her rise, with her eyes full of tears, and go out of the room. Gradually an unhappy shadow fell upon her beauty and deepened every day. Mrs. Markleham was a regular inmate of the cottage then, but she talked and talked and saw nothing. As this change stole on Annie, once like sunshine in the doctor's house, the doctor became older in appearance and more grave. But the sweetness of his temper, the placid kindness of his manner, and his benevolent solicitude for her, if they were capable of any increase, were increased. I saw him once, early on the morning of her birthday, when she came to sit in the window while we were at work, which she'd always done, but now began to do with a timid and uncertain air that I thought very touching. take her forehead between his hands, kiss it, and go hurriedly away, too much moved to remain. I saw her stand where he'd left her like a statue, and then bend down her head and clasp her hands and weep. I cannot say how sorrowfully. Sometimes after that I fancied that she tried to speak even to me in intervals when we were left alone, but she never uttered word. The doctor always had some new project for her participating in amusements away from home with her mother, and Mrs. Markleham, who was very fond of amusements and very easily dissatisfied with anything else, entered into them with great goodwill and was loud in her commendations. But Annie, in a spiritless, unhappy way, only went whither she was led, and seemed to have no care for anything. I didn't know what to think. Neither did my aunt, who must have walked at various times 100 miles in her uncertainty. What was strangest of all was that the only real relief which seemed to make its way into the secret region of this domestic unhappiness made its way there in the person of Mr. Dick. What his thoughts were on the subject, or what his observation was, I am as unable to explain as I dare say he would have been to assist me in the task. But, as I have recorded in the narrative of my school days, his veneration for the doctor was unbounded, and there is a subtlety of perception in real attachment, even when it's borne towards man by one of the lower animals, which leaves the highest intellect behind. To this mind of the heart, if I may call it so, in Mr. Dick, some bright ray of the truth shot straight. He'd proudly resumed his privilege in many of his spare hours of walking up and down the garden with the doctor, as he had been accustomed to pace up and down the doctor's walk at Canterbury. But matters were no sooner in this state than he devoted all his spare time, and got up earlier to make it more, to these perambulations. If he had never been so happy as when the doctor read that marvellous performance, The Dictionary, to him, he was now quite miserable unless the doctor pulled it out of his pocket and began. When the doctor and I were engaged, he now fell into the custom of walking up and down with Mrs. Strong, and helping her to trim her favourite flowers or weed the beds. I dare say he rarely spoke a dozen words in an hour, but his quiet interest and his wistful face found immediate response in both their breasts. Each knew that the other liked him and that he loved both, and he became what no one else could be, a link between them. When I think of him with his impenetrably wise face, walking up and down with the doctor, delighted to be battered by the hard words in the dictionary, when I think of him carrying huge watering pots after Annie, kneeling down in very paws of gloves, a patient, microscopic work among the little leaves, expressing as no philosopher could have expressed in everything he did a delicate desire to be her friend, showering sympathy, trustfulness, and affection out of every hole in the watering pot, when I think of him never wandering in that better mind of his to which unhappiness addressed itself, never bringing the unfortunate King Charles into the garden, never wavering in his grateful service, never diverted from his knowledge that there was something wrong, or from his wish to set it right, I really feel almost ashamed of having known that he was not quite in his wits, taking account of the utmost I have done with mine. "Nobody but myself, Trot, knows what that man is," my aunt would proudly remark when we conversed about it. "Dick will distinguish himself yet." I must refer to one other topic before I close this chapter. While the visit at the doctor's was still in progress, I observed that the postman brought 2 or 3 letters every morning for Uriah Heep, who remained at Highgate until the rest went back, it being a leisure time, and that these were always directed in a business-like manner by Mr. Micawber, who now assumed a round legal hand. I was glad to infer from these slight premises that Mr. Micawber was doing well, and consequently was much surprised to receive, at about this time, the following letter from his amiable wife. Canterbury, Monday evening. You will doubtless be surprised, my dear Mr. Copperfield, to receive this communication. still more so by its contents. Still more so by the stipulation of implicit confidence which I beg to impose. But my feelings as a wife and mother require relief, and as I do not wish to consult my family, already obnoxious to the feelings of Mr. Micawber, I know no one of whom I can better ask advice than my friend and former lodger. You may be aware, my dear Mr. Copperfield, that between myself and Mr. Micawber, whom I will never desert, there has always been preserved a spirit of mutual confidence. Mr. Micawber may have occasionally given a bill without consulting me, or he may have misled me as to the period when that obligation would become due. This has actually happened. But in general, Mr. Micawber has had no secrets from the bosom of his affection, I allude to his wife, and has invariably, on our retirement to rest, recalled the events of the day. You will picture to yourself, my dear Mr. Copperfield, what the poignancy of my feelings must be when I inform you that Mr. Micawber is entirely changed. He is reserved, he is secret, his life is a mystery to the partner of his joys and sorrows, I again allude to his wife. And if I should assure you that beyond knowing that it is passed from morning to night at the office, I now know less of it than I do of the man in the south, connected with whose mouth the thoughtless children repeat an idle tale respecting cold plum porridge, I should adopt a popular fallacy to express an actual fact. But this is not all. Mr. Micawber is morose. He is severe. He is estranged from our eldest son and daughter. He has no pride in his twins. He looks with an eye of coldness even on the unoffending stranger who last became a member of our circle. The pecuniary means of meeting our expenses, kept down to the utmost farthing, are obtained from him with great difficulty, and even under fearful threats that he will settle himself, the exact expression, and he inexorably refuses to give any explanation whatever of this distracting policy. This is hard to bear. This is heartbreaking. If you will advise me, knowing my feeble powers such as they are, how you think it will be best to exert them in a dilemma so unwonted, you will add another friendly obligation to the many you have already rendered me. With loves from the children and a smile from the happily unconscious stranger, I remain, dear Mr. Copperfield, your afflicted Emma Micawber. I didn't feel justified in giving a wife of Mrs. Micawber's experience any other recommendation than that she should try to reclaim Mr. Micawber by patience and kindness, as I knew she would in any case. But the letter set me thinking about him very much. Chapter 43, Another Retrospect. Once again, let me pause upon a memorable period of my life. Let me stand aside to see the phantoms of those days go by, accompanying the shadow of myself in dim procession. Weeks, months, seasons pass along. They seem little more than a summer day and a winter evening. Now the common where I walk with Dora is all in bloom, a field of bright gold. And now the unseen heather lies in mounds and bunches underneath a covering of snow. In a breath, the river that flows through our Sunday walks is sparkling in the summer sun, is ruffled by the winter wind, or thickened with drifting heaps of ice. Faster than ever river ran towards the sea, it flashes, darkens, and rolls away. Not a thread changes in the house of the two little bird-like ladies. The clock ticks over the fireplace, the weather-glass hangs in the hall. Neither clock nor weather-glass is ever right, but we believe in both devoutly.
This ends side one of cassette 20. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
I have come legally to man's estate. I have attained the dignity of 21. But this is a sort of dignity that may be thrust upon one. Let me think what I've achieved. I've tamed that savage stenographic mystery. I make a respectable income by it. I'm in high repute for my accomplishment in all pertaining to the art, and am joined with 11 others in reporting the debates in Parliament for a morning newspaper. Night after night I record predictions that never come to pass, professions that are never fulfilled, explanations that are only meant to mystify. I wallow in words. Britannia, that unfortunate female, is always before me, like a trussed fowl, skewered through and through with office pens and bound hand and foot with red tape. I am sufficiently behind the scenes to know the worth of political life. I'm quite an infidel about it and shall never be converted. My dear old Traddles has tried his hand at the same pursuit, but it is not in Traddles' way. He's perfectly good-humoured respecting his failure, and reminds me that he always did consider himself slow. He has occasional employment on the same newspaper in getting up the facts of dry subjects to be written about and embellished by more fertile minds. He's called to the bar, and with admirable industry and self-denial, has scraped another £100 together to fee a conveyancer whose chambers he attends. A great deal of very hot port wine was consumed at his call, and considering the figure, I should think the Inner Temple must have made a profit by it. I have come out in another way. I have taken with fear and trembling to authorship. I wrote a little something in secret and sent it to a magazine, and it was published in the magazine. Since then, I have taken heart to write a good many trifling pieces. Now I am regularly paid for them. Altogether, I'm well off. When I tell my income on the fingers of my left hand, I pass the third finger and take in the fourth to the middle joint. We have removed from Buckingham Street to a pleasant little cottage very near the one I looked at when my enthusiasm first came on. My aunt, however, who has sold the house at Dover to good advantage, is not going to remain here, but intends removing herself to a still more tiny cottage close at hand. What does this portend? My marriage? Yes. Yes, I am going to be married to Dora. Miss Lavinia and Miss Clarissa have given their consent, and if ever canary birds were in a flutter, they are. Miss Lavinia, self-charged with the superintendence of my darling's wardrobe, is constantly cutting out brown paper cuirasses and differing in opinion from a highly respectable young man with a long bundle and a yard measure under his arm. A dressmaker, always stabbed in the breast with a needle and thread, boards and lodges in the house, and seems to me, eating, drinking or sleeping, never to take her thimble off. They make a lay figure of my dear. They are always sending for her to come and try something on. We can't be happy together for 5 minutes in the evening, but some intrusive female knocks at the door and says, "Oh, if you please, Miss Dora, would you step upstairs?" Miss Clarissa and my aunt roam all over London to find out articles of furniture for Dora and me to look at. It would be better for them to buy the goods at once without this ceremony of inspection, for when we go to see a kitchen fender and a meat screen, Dora sees a Chinese house for Jip with little bells on the top and prefers that. And it takes a long time to accustom Jip to his new residence after we've bought it. Whenever he goes in or out, he makes all the little bells ring and is horribly frightened. Peggotty comes up to make herself useful and falls to work immediately. Her department appears to be to clean everything over and over again. She rubs everything that can be rubbed until it shines like her own honest forehead with perpetual friction. And now it is that I begin to see her solitary brother passing through the dark streets at night and looking as he goes among the wandering faces. I never speak to him at such an hour. I know too well as his grave figure passes onward what he seeks and what he dreads. Why does Traddles look so important when he calls upon me this afternoon in the Commons, where I still occasionally attend for form's sake when I have time? The realization of my boyish daydreams is at hand. I am going to take out the license. It's a little document to do so much, and Traddles contemplates it as it lies upon my desk, half in admiration, half in awe. There are the names in the sweet old visionary connection, David Copperfield and Dora Spenlow. And there, in the corner, is that parental institution, the Stamp Office. which is so benignantly interested in the various transactions of human life, looking down upon our union. And there is the Archbishop of Canterbury invoking a blessing on us in print, and doing it as cheap as could possibly be expected. Nevertheless, I am in a dream. A flustered, happy, hurried dream. I can't believe that it's going to be. And yet I can't believe but that everyone I pass in the street must have some kind of perception that I am to be married the day after tomorrow. The surrogate knows me when I go down to be sworn, and disposes of me easily as if there were a Masonic understanding between us. Traddles is not at all wanted, but is in attendance as my general backup. "I hope the next time you come here, my dear fellow," I say to Traddles, "it'll be on the same errand for yourself, and I hope it'll be soon." "Thank you for your good wishes, my dear Copperfield," he replies. "I hope so, too. It's a satisfaction to know that she'll wait for me any length of time, and that she really is the dearest girl." "When are you to meet her at the coach?" I ask. "At 7, says Traddles, looking at his plain old silver watch. "The very watch he once took a wheel out of at school to make a watermill. That's about Miss Wickfield's time, is it not?" "A little earlier. Her time is 8:30. "I assure you, my dear boy," says Traddles, "I am almost as pleased as if I were going to be married myself to think that this event is coming to such a happy termination. And really, the great friendship and consideration of personally associating Sophie with the joyful occasion and inviting her to be a bridesmaid in conjunction with Miss Wickfield demands my warmest thanks. I am extremely sensible of it." I hear him and shake hands with him, and we talk and walk and dine and so on, but I don't believe it. Nothing is real. Sophie arrives at the house of Dora's aunts in due course. She has the most agreeable of faces. Not absolutely beautiful, but extraordinarily pleasant, and is one of the most genial, unaffected, frank, engaging creatures I have ever seen. Traddles presents her to us with great pride, and rubs his hands for 10 minutes by the clock, with every individual hair upon his head standing on tiptoe, when I congratulate him in a corner on his choice. I've brought Agnes from the Canterbury coach, and her cheerful and beautiful face is among us for the second time. Agnes has a great liking for Traddles, and it's capital to see them meet and to observe the glory of Traddles as he commends the dearest girl in the world to her acquaintance. Still, I don't believe it. We have a delightful evening, are supremely happy, but I don't believe it yet. I can't collect myself. I can't check off my happiness as it takes place. I feel in a misty and unsettled kind of state, as if I'd got up very early in the morning a week or two ago and had never been to bed since. I can't make out when yesterday was. I seem to have been carrying the license about in my pocket many months. Next day, too, when we all go in a flock to see the house, our house, Dora's and mine, I am quite unable to regard myself as its master. I seem to be there by permission of somebody else. I half expect the real master to come home presently and say he's glad to see me. Such a beautiful little house as it is, with everything so bright and new, with the flowers on the carpets looking as if freshly gathered, and the green leaves on the paper as if they had just come out, with the spotless muslin curtains and the blushing rose-coloured furniture and Dora's garden hat with the blue ribbon. Do I remember now how I loved her in such another hat when I first knew her? Already hanging on its little peg. The guitar case quite at home on its heels in a corner. And everybody tumbling over Gyp's pagoda, which is much too big for the establishment. Another happy evening, quite as unreal as all the rest of it. And I steal into the usual room before going away. Dora's not there. I suppose they've not done trying on yet. Miss Lavinia peeps in and tells me mysteriously that she will not be long. She is rather long, notwithstanding. But by and by I hear a rustling at the door and someone taps. I say, "Come in." But someone taps again. I go to the door, wondering who it is. There I meet a pair of bright eyes and a blushing face. They're Dora's eyes and face, and Miss Lavinia has dressed her in tomorrow's dress, bonnet and all, for me to see. I take my little wife to my heart. And Miss Lavinia gives a little scream because I tumble the bonnet, and Dora laughs and cries at once because I'm so pleased, and I believe it less than ever. "Do you think it pretty, Dodie?" says Dora. "Pretty? I should rather think I did." "Are you sure you like me very much?" says Dora. The topic is fraught with such danger to the bonnet that Miss Lavinia gives another little scream and begs me to understand that Dora is only to be looked at and on no account to be touched. So Dora stands in a delightful state of confusion for a minute or two to be admired, and then takes off the bonnet, looking so natural without it, and runs away with it in her hand and comes dancing down again in her own familiar dress and asks Jip if I've got a beautiful little wife and whether he'll forgive her for being married, and kneels down to make him stand upon the cookery book for the last time in her single life. I go home, more incredulous than ever, to a lodging that I have hard by, and get up very early in the morning to ride to the Highgate Road and fetch my aunt. I've never seen my aunt in such state. She is dressed in lavender-coloured silk, and has a white bonnet on, and is amazing. Janet has dressed her and is there to look at me. Peggotty is ready to go to church, intending to behold the ceremony from the gallery. Mr. Dick, who is to give my darling to me at the altar, has had his hair curled. Traddles, whom I have taken up by appointment at the turnpike, presents a dazzling combination of cream colour and light blue, and both he and Mr. Dick have a general effect about them of being all gloves. No doubt I see this because I know it's so, but I'm astray and seem to see nothing. Nor do I believe anything whatever. Still, as we drive along in an open carriage, this fairy marriage is real enough to fill me with a sort of wondering pity for the unfortunate people who have no part in it but are sweeping out the shops and going to their daily occupations. My aunt sits with my hand in hers all the way. When we stop, a little way short of the church, to put down Peggotty, whom we've brought on the box, she gives it a squeeze and me a kiss. God bless you, Trot! My own boy never could be dearer. I think of poor dear baby this morning. So do I. And of all I owe to you, dear aunt. Ah, child, says my aunt, and gives her hand in overflowing cordiality to Traddles, who then gives his to Mr. Dick, who then gives his to me, who then gives mine to Traddles, and then we come to the church door. The church is calm enough, I'm sure, but it might be a steam-power loom in full action for any sedative effect it has on me. I'm too far gone for that. The rest is all a more or less incoherent dream. A dream of their coming in with Dora, of the pew-opener arranging us like a drill sergeant before the altar rails, of my wondering even then why pew-openers must always be the most disagreeable females procurable, and whether there is any religious dread of a disastrous infection of good humour which renders it indispensable to set those vessels of vinegar upon the road to heaven, of the clergyman and clerk appearing, of a few boatmen and some other people strolling in, of an ancient mariner behind me strongly flavouring the church with rum, of the service beginning in a deep voice and our all being very attentive, of Miss Lavinia, who acts as a semi-auxiliary bridesmaid, being the first to cry, and of her doing homage, as I take it, to the memory of Pidger in sobs, of Miss Clarissa applying a smelling bottle, of Agnes taking care of Dora, of my aunt endeavouring to represent herself as a model of sternness with tears rolling down her face, of little Dora trembling very much and making her responses in faint whispers, of our kneeling down together side by side, of Dora's trembling less and less but always clasping Agnes by the hand, of the service being got through quietly and gravely, of our all looking at each other in an April state of smiles and tears when it's over, of my young wife being hysterical in the vestry and crying for her poor papa, her dear papa. Of her soon cheering up again, and us signing the register all round, of my going into the gallery for Peggotty to bring her to sign it, of Peggotty's hugging me in a corner and telling me she saw my own dear mother married, of its being over and our going away, of my walking so proudly and lovingly down the aisle with my sweet wife upon my arm, through a mist of half-seen people, pulpits, monuments, pews, fonts, organs, and church windows, in which there flutter faint airs of association with my childish church at home so long ago, of their whispering as we pass, what a youthful couple we are, and what a pretty little wife she is, of our all being so merry and talkative in the carriage going back, of Sophie telling us that when she saw Traddles, whom I had entrusted with the license, asked for it, she almost fainted, having been convinced that he would contrive to lose it, or to have his pocket picked, of Agnes laughing gaily, and of Dora being so fond of Agnes that she will not be separated from her, but still keeps her hand, of there being a breakfast, with abundance of things pretty and substantial to eat and drink, whereof I partake, as I should do in any other dream without the least perception of their flavour, eating and drinking, as I may say, nothing but love and marriage, and no more believing in the viands than in anything else. Of my making a speech in the same dreamy fashion without having an idea of what I want to say, beyond such as may be comprehended in the full conviction that I haven't said it. Of our being very sociably and simply happy, always in a dream, though, and of Gyps having wedding cake and its not agreeing with him afterwards, of the pair of hired post-horses being ready, and of Dora's going away to change her dress, of my aunt and Miss Clarissa remaining with us, and our walking in the garden, and my aunt, who has made quite a speech at breakfast touching Dora's aunts, being mightily amused with herself, but a little proud of it, too, of Dora's being ready, and of Miss Lavinia's hovering about her, loath to lose the pretty toy that has given her so much pleasant occupation, of Dora making a long series of surprised discoveries that she's forgotten all sorts of little things, and of everybody's running everywhere to fetch them, of their all closing about Dora, when at last she begins to say good-bye, looking, with their bright colours and ribbons, like a bed of flowers, of my darling being almost smothered among the flowers and coming out laughing and crying both together to my jealous arms, of my wanting to carry Gyp, who is to go along with us, and Dora saying no, that she must carry him, or else he'll think she don't like him any more now she's married and will break his heart, of our going arm in arm and Dora stopping and looking back and saying, if I have ever been cross or ungrateful to anybody, don't remember it, and bursting into tears, of her waving her little hand, and our going away once more, of her once more stopping and looking back and hurrying to Agnes and giving Agnes above all the others her last kisses and farewells. We drive away together, and I awake from the dream. I believe it at last. It is my dear, dear little wife beside me, whom I love so well. Are you happy now, you foolish boy, says Dora, and sure you don't repent? I've stood aside to see the phantoms of those days go by me. They're gone, and I resume the journey of my story. Chapter 44, Our Housekeeping. It was a strange condition of things, the honeymoon being over and the bridesmaids gone home, when I found myself sitting down in my own small house with Dora, quite thrown out of employment, as I may say, in respect of the delicious old occupation of making love. It seemed such an extraordinary thing to have Dora always there. It was so unaccountable not to be obliged to go out to see her, not to have any occasion to be tormenting myself about her, not to have to write to her, not to be scheming and devising opportunities of being alone with her. Sometimes of an evening, when I looked up from my writing and saw her seated opposite, I would lean back in my chair and think how queer it was that there we were, alone, together, as a matter of course. Nobody's business any more. All the romance of our engagement put away upon a shelf to rust. No one to please but one another. One another to please for life. When there was a debate and I was kept out very late, it seemed so strange to me as I was walking home to think that Dora was at home. It was such a wonderful thing at first to have her coming softly down to talk to me as I ate my supper. It was such a stupendous thing to know for certain that she put her hair in papers. It was altogether such an astonishing event to see her do it. I doubt whether two young birds could have known less about keeping house than I and my pretty Dora did. We had a servant, of course. She kept house for us. I have still a latent belief that she must have been Mrs. Crupp's daughter in disguise. We had such an awful time of it with Mary Ann. Her name was Paragon. Her nature was represented to us when we engaged her as being feebly expressed in her name. She had a written character as large as a proclamation, and, according to this document, could do everything of a domestic nature that ever I heard of, and a great many things that I never did hear of. She was a woman in the prime of life, of a severe countenance, and subject, particularly in the arms, to a sort of perpetual measles or fiery rash. She had a cousin in the lifeguards with such long legs that he looked like the afternoon shadow of somebody else. His shell jacket was as much too little for him as he was too big for the premises. He made the cottage smaller than it need have been by being so very much out of proportion to it. Besides which, the walls were not thick, and whenever he passed the evening at our house, we always knew of it by hearing one continual growl in the kitchen. Our treasure was warranted sober and honest. I am therefore willing to believe that she was in a fit when we found her under the boiler, and that the deficient teaspoons were attributable to the dustman. But she preyed upon our minds dreadfully. We felt our inexperience and were unable to help ourselves. We should have been at her mercy if she'd had any, but she was a remorseless woman and had none. She was the cause of our first little quarrel. "My dearest life," I said one day to Dora, "do you think Mary Ann has any idea of time?" "Why, Dodie?" inquired Dora, looking up innocently from her drawing. "My love, because it's 5, and we were to have dined at 4. Dora glanced wistfully at the clock and hinted that she thought it was too fast. "On the contrary, my love," said I, referring to my watch, "it's a few minutes too slow." My little wife came and sat upon my knee to coax me to be quiet and drew a line with her pencil down the middle of my nose, but I couldn't dine off that, though it was very agreeable. "Don't you think, my dear," said I, "it would be better for you to remonstrate with Mary Ann?" "Oh, no, please, I couldn't, Dodie," said Dora. "Why not, my love?" I gently asked. "Oh, because I'm such a little goose," said Dora, "and she knows I am." I thought this sentiment so incompatible with the establishment of any system of check on Mary Ann that I frowned a little. "Oh, what ugly wrinkles in my bad boy's forehead," said Dora, and still being on my knee, she traced them with her pencil, putting it to her rosy lips to make it mark blacker, and working at my forehead with a quaint little mockery of being industrious that quite delighted me in spite of myself. "There's a good child," said Dora. "It makes its face so much prettier to laugh." "But, my love," said I. "No, no, please," cried Dora with a kiss. "Don't be a naughty Bluebeard. Don't be serious." "My precious wife," said I, "we must be serious sometimes. Come, sit down on this chair close beside me. Give me the pencil. There. Now, let us talk sensibly. You know, my dear..." What a little hand it was to hold, and what a tiny wedding ring it was to see. "You know, my love, it is not exactly comfortable to have to go out without one's dinner, now is it?"
No,
replied Dora faintly. "My love, how you tremble."
"Because I know you're going to scold me,"
exclaimed Dora in a piteous voice. "My sweet, I'm only going to reason." "Oh, but reasoning is worse than scolding," exclaimed Dora in despair. "I didn't marry to be reasoned with. If you meant to reason with such a poor little thing as I am, you ought to have told me so, you cruel boy." I tried to pacify Dora, but she turned away her face and shook her curls from side to side and said, "You cruel, cruel boy," so many times that I really didn't exactly know what to do. So I took a few turns up and down the room in my uncertainty and came back again. "Dora, my darling." "No, I'm not your darling, because you must be sorry that you married me, or else you wouldn't reason with me," returned Dora. I felt so injured by the inconsequential nature of this charge that it gave me courage to be grave. "Now, my own Dora," said I, "you are very childish and are talking nonsense. You must remember, I'm sure, that I was obliged to go out yesterday when dinner was half over, and that the day before I was made quite unwell by being obliged to eat underdone veal in a hurry. Today I don't dine at all, and I'm afraid to say how long we waited for breakfast, and then the water didn't boil. I don't mean to reproach you, my dear, but this is not comfortable." "Oh, you cruel, cruel boy, to say I'm a disagreeable wife," cried Dora. "Now, my dear Dora, you must know that I never said that." "You said I wasn't comfortable," said Dora. "I said the housekeeping was not comfortable." "It's exactly the same thing," cried Dora. And she evidently thought so, for she wept most grievously. I took another turn across the room, full of love for my pretty wife, and distracted by self-accusatory inclinations to knock my head against the door. I sat down again and said, "I am not blaming you, Dora. We have both a great deal to learn. I'm only trying to show you, my dear, that you must... you really must..." I was resolved not to give this up. "Accustom yourself to look after Mary Ann. Likewise, to act a little for yourself and me." "I wonder I do at your making such ungrateful speeches," sobbed Dora, "when you know that the other day, when you said you would like a little bit of fish, I went out by myself miles and miles and ordered it to surprise you." "And it was very kind of you, my own darling," said I. "I felt it so much that I wouldn't on any account have even mentioned that you bought a salmon, which was too much for two, or that it cost £1.06, which was more than we can afford." "You enjoyed it very much," sobbed Dora, "and you said I was a mouse." "And I'll say so again, my love," I returned, "a thousand times." But I had wounded Dora's soft little heart, and she was not to be comforted. She was so pathetic in her sobbing and bewailing that I felt as if I'd said I don't know what to hurt her. I was obliged to hurry away. I was kept out late, and I felt all night such pangs of remorse as made me miserable. I had the conscience of an assassin, and was haunted by a vague sense of enormous wickedness. It was 2 or 3 hours past midnight when I got home. I found my aunt in our house, sitting up for me. "Is anything the matter, aunt?" said I, alarmed. "Nothing, Trot," she replied. "Sit down, sit down. Little Blossom has been rather out of spirits, and I've been keeping her company, that's all." I leant my head upon my hand, and felt more sorry and downcast as I sat looking at the fire than I could have supposed possible so soon after the fulfilment of my brightest hopes. As I sat thinking, I happened to meet my aunt's eyes, which were resting on my face. There was an anxious expression in them, but it cleared directly. "I assure you, aunt," said I, "I've been quite unhappy myself all night to think of Dora's being so. But I had no other intention than to speak to her tenderly and lovingly about our home affairs." My aunt nodded encouragement. "You must have patience, Trot," said she. "Of course. Heaven knows I don't mean to be unreasonable, aunt." "No, no," said my aunt, "but Little Blossom is a very tender little blossom, and the wind must be gentle with her." I thanked my good aunt in my heart for her tenderness towards my wife, and I was sure that she knew I did. "Don't you think, aunt," said I, after some further contemplation of the fire, "that you could advise and counsel Dora a little for our mutual advantage now and then?" trot," returned my aunt with some emotion. "No, don't ask me such a thing." Her tone was so very earnest that I raised my eyes in surprise. "I look back on my life, child," said my aunt, "and I think of some who are in their graves with whom I might have been on kinder terms. If I judged harshly of other people's mistakes in marriage, it may have been because I had bitter reason to judge harshly of my own. Let that pass. I've been a grumpy, frumpy, wayward sort of a woman a good many years. I am still, and I always shall be. But you and I have done one another some good, Trot. At all events, you've done me good, my dear. And division must not come between us at this time of day." "Division between us?" cried I. "Child, child," said my aunt, smoothing her dress, "how soon it might come between us, or how unhappy I might make our little Blossom, if I meddled in anything a prophet couldn't say. I want our pet to like me and be as gay as a butterfly. Remember your own home in that second marriage, and never do both me and her the injury you have hinted at." I comprehended at once that my aunt was right, and I comprehended the full extent of her generous feeling towards my dear wife. "These are early days, Trot," she pursued, "and Rome was not built in a day, nor in a year. You have chosen freely for yourself." A cloud passed over her face for a moment, I thought. "And you have chosen a very pretty and a very affectionate creature. It will be your duty, and it will be your pleasure too. Of course, I know that. I'm not delivering a lecture. To estimate her as you chose her, by the qualities she has, and not by the qualities she may not have. The latter you must develop in her if you can. And if you cannot, child," here my aunt rubbed her nose, "you must just accustom yourself to do without 'em. But remember, my dear, your future is between you two. No one can assist you. You are to work it out for yourselves. This is marriage, Trot. And heaven bless you both in it, for a pair of babes in the wood as you are." My aunt said this in a sprightly way and gave me a kiss to ratify the blessing. "Now," said she, "light my little lantern and see me into my bandbox by the garden path." For there was a communication between our cottages in that direction. "Give Betsy Trotwood's love to Blossom when you come back, and whatever you do, Trot, never dream of setting Betsy up as a scarecrow, for if I ever saw her in the glass, she's quite grim enough and gaunt enough in her private capacity." With this, my aunt tied her head up in a handkerchief, with which she was accustomed to make a bundle of it on such occasions, and I escorted her home. As she stood in her garden, holding up her little lantern to light me back, I thought her observation of me had an anxious air again. But I was too much occupied in pondering on what she'd said, and too much impressed, for the first time in reality, by the conviction that Dora and I had indeed to work out our future for ourselves, and that no one could assist us, to take much notice of it. Dora came stealing down in her little slippers to meet me, now that I was alone, and cried upon my shoulder, and said I'd been hard-hearted and she'd been naughty, and I said much the same thing, in effect, I believe. And we made it up, and agreed that our first little difference was to be our last, and that we were never to have another if we lived 100 years. The next domestic trial we went through was the ordeal of servants. Mary Ann's cousin deserted into our coal-hole, and was brought out, to our great amazement, by a PK of his companions in arms, who took him away handcuffed in a procession that covered our front garden with ignominy. This nerved me to get rid of Mary Ann, who went so mildly on receipt of wages that I was surprised, until I found out about the teaspoons, and also about the little sum she'd borrowed in my name of the tradespeople without authority. After an interval of Mrs. Kidgerbury, the oldest inhabitant of Kentish Town, I believe, who went out charring, but was too feeble to execute her conceptions of that art, we found another treasurer, who was one of the most amiable of women, but who generally made a point of falling either up or down the kitchen stairs with the tray, and almost always plunged into the parlour as into a bath with the tea things. The ravages committed by this unfortunate, rendering her dismissal necessary, she was succeeded, with intervals of Mrs. Kidgerbury, by a long line of incapables, terminating in a young person of genteel appearance who went to Greenwich Fair in Dora's bonnet, after whom I remember nothing but an average equality of failure. Everybody we had anything to do with seemed to cheat us. Our appearance in a shop was a signal for the damaged goods to be brought out immediately. If we bought a lobster, it was full of water. All our meat turned out to be tough, and there was hardly any crust to our loaves. In search of the principle on which joints ought to be roasted enough and not too much, I myself referred to the cookery book, and found it there established as the allowance of a quarter of an hour to every pound, and say a quarter over. But the principle always failed us by some curious fatality, and we never could hit any medium between redness and cinders. I had reason to believe that in accomplishing these failures, we incurred a far greater expense than if we'd achieved a series of triumphs. It appeared to me, on looking over the tradesmen's books, as if we might have kept the basement story paved with butter, such was the extensive scale of our consumption of that article. I don't know whether the excise returns of the period may have exhibited any increase in the demand for pepper, but if our performances did not affect the market, I should say several families must have left off using it. And the most wonderful fact of all was that we never had anything in the house. As to the washerwoman pawning the clothes and coming in a state of penitent intoxication to apologise, I suppose that might have happened several times to anybody. Also the chimney on fire, the parish engine, and perjury on the part of the beadle. But I apprehend that we were personally unfortunate in engaging a servant with a taste for cordials, who swelled our running account for porter at the public house by such inexplicable items as quartern rum shrub, Mrs. C, half quartern gin and cloves, Mrs. C, glass rum and peppermint, Mrs. C, the parenthesis always referring to Dora, who was supposed, it appeared on explanation, to have imbibed the whole of these refreshments. One of our first feats in the housekeeping way was a little dinner to Traddles. I met him in town and asked him to walk out with me that afternoon. He, readily consenting, I wrote to Dora, saying I would bring him home. It was pleasant weather, and on the road we made my domestic happiness the theme of conversation. Traddles was very full of it, and said that, picturing himself with such a home, and Sophie waiting and preparing for him, he could think of nothing wanting to complete his bliss. I couldn't have wished for a prettier wife at the opposite end of the table, but I certainly could have wished, when we sat down for a little more room. I didn't know how it was, but though there were only two of us, we were at once always cramped for room, and yet had always room enough to lose everything in. I suspect it may have been because nothing had a place of its own except Jip's pagoda, which invariably blocked up the main thoroughfare. On the present occasion, Traddles was so hemmed in by the pagoda and the guitar case and Dora's flower painting and my writing table that I had serious doubts of the possibility of his using his knife and fork, but he protested with his own good humour, "Oceans of room, Copperfield, I assure you, oceans!" There was another thing I could have wished, namely that Jip had never been encouraged to walk about the tablecloth during dinner. I began to think there was something disorderly in his being there at all, even if he'd not been in the habit of putting his foot in the salt or the melted butter. On this occasion he seemed to think he was introduced expressly to keep Traddles at bay, and he barked at my old friend and made short runs at his plate with such undaunted pertinacity that he may be said to have engrossed the conversation. However, as I knew how tender-hearted my dear Dora was, and how sensitive she would be to any slight upon her favourite, I hinted no objection. For similar reason I made no allusion to the skirmishing plates upon the floor, or to the disreputable appearance of the casters, which were all of sixes and sevens and looked drunk, or to the further blockade of Traddles by wandering vegetable dishes and jugs. I couldn't help wondering in my own mind, as I contemplated the boiled leg of mutton before me previous to carving it, how it came to pass that our joints of meat were of such extraordinary shapes, and whether our butcher contracted for all the deformed sheep that came into the world. But I kept my reflections to myself. "My love," said I to Dora, "what have you got in that dish?" I couldn't imagine why Dora had been making tempting little faces at me, as if she wanted to kiss me. "Oysters, dear," said Dora, timidly. "Was that your fault?" said I, delighted. "Yes, Dodie," said Dora. "There never was a happier one," I exclaimed, laying down the carving knife and fork. "There's nothing Traddles likes so much." "Yes, Dodie," said Dora. "And so I bought a beautiful little barrel of them, and the man said they were very good, but I'm afraid there's something the matter with them. They don't seem right." Here Dora shook her head, and diamonds twinkled in her eyes. "They're only opened in both shells," said I. "Take the top one off, my love." "But it won't come off," said Dora, trying very hard and looking very much distressed. "Do you know, Copperfield," said Traddles, cheerfully examining the dish, "I think it is in consequence, they're capital oysters, but I think it's in consequence of their never having been opened." They never had been opened. And we had no oyster knives, and couldn't have used them if we had. So we looked at the oysters and at the mutton. At least we ate as much of it as was done, and made up with capers. If I'd permitted him, I'm satisfied that Traddles would have made a perfect savage of himself and eaten a plateful of raw meat to express enjoyment of the repast. But I would hear of no such immolation on the altar of friendship, and we had a course of bacon instead. There happening by good fortune to be cold bacon in the larder. My poor little wife was in such affliction when she thought I should be annoyed, and in such a state of joy when she found I was not, that the discomfiture I had subdued very soon vanished, and we passed a happy evening, Dora sitting with her arm on my chair while Traddles and I discussed a glass of wine, and taking every opportunity of whispering in my ear that it was so good of me not to be a cruel, cross old boy. By and by she made tea for us, which it was so pretty to see her do, as if she were busying herself with a set of dolls' tea things, that I was not particular about the quality of the beverage. Then Traddles and I played a game or two at cribbage, and Dora singing to the guitar the while, it seemed to me as if our courtship and marriage were a tender dream of mine, and the night when I first listened to her voice were not yet over.
This ends side 2 of cassette 20 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 21. Cassette 21.
When Traddles went away, and I came back into the parlour from seeing him out, my wife planted her chair close to mine and sat down by my side. "I'm very sorry," she said. "Will you try to teach me, Dodie?"
"I must teach myself first, Dora," said I. "I'm as bad as you, my love."
"Ah, but you can learn," she returned, "and you're a clever, clever man."
"Nonsense, Mouse," said I.
"I wish," resumed my wife after a long silence, "that I could have gone down into the country for a whole year and lived with Agnes."
Her hands were clasped upon my shoulder, and her chin rested on them, and her blue eyes looked quietly into mine.
"Why so?" I asked. "I think she might have improved me, and I think I might have learnt from her," said Dora.
"All in good time, my love. Agnes has had her father to take care of these many years, you should remember. Even when she was quite a child, she was the Agnes whom we know," said I.
"Will you call me a name I want you to call me?" inquired Dora, without moving.
"What is it?" I asked with a smile. It's a stupid name, she said, shaking her curls for a moment. Childwife. I laughingly asked my childwife what her fancy was in desiring to be so called. She answered without moving, otherwise than as the arm I twined about her may have brought her blue eyes nearer to me, I don't mean, you silly fellow, that you should use the name.